This is A New Angle, a show about cool people doing awesome things in and around Montana. I'm your host, Justin Angle. This show is supported by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and the University of Montana College of Business. Hey folks, welcome back, and thanks for tuning in. Today is our October edition of Incentives and Instincts, a recurring monthly series in which I speak with economist and friend Bryce Ward about some of the broader challenges facing our society. Last month, we discussed wealth and income inequality. An important cause and remedy for inequality is education. And the COVID-19 pandemic we're living through is having all sorts of interesting and alarming effects on educational outcomes. So today, we'll try to give you the state of play, as we know it, when it comes to the effect of the pandemic on education. Bryce, how's it going today?
Good, although the fact that we're still talking about the pandemic is somewhat depressing. But yeah.
Well, let's just sort of set that one aside because we're in it and we're planning to talk about it. So let's just walk listeners through the highlights and, well, maybe the lowlights of how COVID has affected education in general.
So obviously, when the pandemic first hit and everybody got sent home, there was not a ton of learning that took place during that period. The studies that we have in a variety of countries, rich and poor, found, that there, on average, there was basically no learning.
And that's not a huge surprise at all. You shut down the schools, you send the kids home, you cobble together some form of, you know, online instruction. To the extent learning was happening, it was probably happening in the better resourced areas, but in general, it's pretty bad.
Yeah. And so then we get through to a full school year where we have a whole bunch of different modes of learning going on.
This is like an economist's dream.
It is, although it's somewhat disappointing that there hasn't been better data collection. They're starting to do a better job of trying to piece it together ex post of what each district was doing so that then we can map it to various learning outcomes and basically say, oh, here was the effect of X, Y, and Z on learning. But just in general, even from before the pandemic and what we've learned through the pandemic is regular schooling is better for the most people than all these kind of amalgams. It's not to say that some individuals don't thrive in these environments, because they do, but for...
And we say regular school, it's traditional
in-person,
public education.
5-day-a-week schooling, right? So, you know, we know that that is a relatively effective model of educating young people.
Sure.
You know, so some of the studies basically, so one of the studies that I can recall... So there's these test companies. Right? So one of the ones, which is what we use at the school that my kids go to, they give kind of these computer-assisted tests three times a year, and they're nationally normed to a distribution that exists before the pandemic. So they were able to say, okay, well, amongst the kids who took tests in the school year 2020-2021, where did they fall within this pre-pandemic distribution? And they basically found that it wasn't huge, but it was down 6 to 10 percentile points.
Okay.
Right. You know, and that varies, you know, as you move into other parts of the globe, right, it's much worse. And, you know, it depends on what district you're in and what type, you know, so there's, you know, kind of going back to the link to inequality, it's only increasing the inequality in our educational outcomes, right? So basically, if you are in some form of disadvantaged population in a country or a district or a community, you are much more likely to show worse outcomes through this then, you know, and in fact, one of my friends who's one of the people who writes these papers, right, I'm on a call with him a few weeks ago. He was even joking. He's like, look, it doesn't matter what my kids do. They'll be fine. But, you know, when you're talking about other parts of the population where there isn't as much at-home supplement if the school isn't there or isn't doing as much as it could, those are where we're most concerned about worse outcomes, which then linking back to inequality over the long term may actually just exacerbate inequality because we've, you know, we're not keeping up in that race between education and technology that we talked about last time.
And do we know, you know, within those disadvantaged groups, like what different sorts of modalities were employed and the effects of those modalities? Have we been able to get that granular yet?
Yeah, in some places, yes. Even where in-person schooling was an option, frequently it was minority parents, more disadvantaged parents, who were the most likely to opt out.
Yeah, that study out of Michigan you sent me said that. Yeah, they were more likely to opt for
the online homeschool approach.
And so, but there's a few different things happening. There's like schools, public schools are switching to some form of remote. Public schools are doing some hybrid of in-person. And then there's families that are opting for homeschool, and then families that are putting their children in private schools.
And families just delaying putting kids in school at all, right? So the biggest effects that we saw in enrollment were in kindergarten. I think nationally we're missing like 10 million kindergartners
missing
last year.
Missing. Just off the rolls.
Just did not show up in any form of enrolled school. And I think some of that's coming back this year. They're just basically, they just got redshirted in some sense.
Sat out,
right?
Yeah.
They just sat out for a year, and now, if I recall correctly, like the kindergarten classes in many school districts this year are enormous.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas the first grade classes are somewhat small.
Which probably, yeah, that'll have all kinds of effects as that cohort moves through the system. That cohort will probably be much more competitive than the previous cohort, presumably, if they catch up, I suppose.
Yeah. No. Class size matters. Cohort size matters. It affects, you know, And the age distribution of kids in the class matters.
Yeah, not only just in terms of their educational horsepower or their just sort of what they're ready for cognitively, but non-cognitively too. Like this, the social interactions between just the difference between a 5 and a 6-year-old is enormous, or can be enormous.
It can be enormous, right? You know, I mean, I have a first grader.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can see the difference between the kids who are kind of September birthdays and the kids who are June birthdays that are both in the same class.
Right.
Yeah, there's a difference because at that age, you're talking about like almost 20% difference in, you know, life experience.
Okay, so we know about this missing cohort of kindergartners. We know about some of the other modalities and the effects on in various populations. What other pieces of the puzzle do we need?
Okay, so there's a couple other things that COVID has done. First, there's a series that tracks, like they ask parents on a regular basis about misbehavior and kind of anxiety amongst their kids,
okay.
Right? And so caregivers reporting how much the phrase fussy or defiant fits their child's behavior in the last week. Pre-pandemic, about a third of parents said that about their kind of youngest kids.
Yeah.
And since the pandemic started, it has been steady at 50%.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And if you ask,
I'm probably well above 50% myself. I don't know about you.
It's gone through phases. And the other question they ask is how much the phrase too fearful or anxious fits their child's behavior. And pre-pandemic, that was like 13-14%, and it's been above 20% steadily since. So, you know, there's these kind of social emotional issues that we're seeing in some data. And so it's worth asking, okay, well, what's going on with that? Now, a small part, and this isn't huge, but it's still a big number if you think about it, right? So I think a study came out this week which suggested that 175,000 kids have lost at least one of their primary caregivers due to COVID. So we've got a it's basically one out of every four COVID deaths likely is leaving behind a minor child.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've got that, which is, it's small within the big giant population.
But it's a lot of kids.
But it's a lot of kids, and it's a big shock.
And when if thinking about it from the perspective of our education system, you've got a teacher in a classroom with somewhere between 20 and 30 students. And, you know, from the perspective of a teacher, it's, in a small classroom, you can give somebody a lot of attention, but if you have to spread your attention across 20 to 30 students with COVID, you're being asked to do all this other stuff too. It's going to be really hard to make sure those sorts of kids aren't getting left behind.
Yeah, so there's the direct COVID death, but then you know that's the deaths, right? Now we've got the kids who've got parents who've been hospitalized and are maybe dealing with long COVID. You know, I mean, it grows into a still small, but again, as you point out, even if it's just a handful of kids spread across a cohort within an elementary school, you already had all the traditional issues going on. Right now, you've got these issues. You've got the other elevated ones that we just talked about. That's just everybody,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, and then kind of lurking behind all of this is that we've just interrupted some of our traditional ways of developing social emotional skills. Like, you know, I know lots of kids who were basically locked down for a year, right? They did not see friends.
Yeah.
Right? They saw them on Zoom screens or FaceTime calls, but they weren't doing basketball and soccer and dancing and the art camp or, you know, all that kind of stuff. We're kind of, we don't know what happens when you take that out at different ages, and we're gonna learn about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, so we've got, just got a host of issues related to not just the cognitive skills that we see in test scores, but also this interrupted social emotional development that we know actually, honestly, if you're putting a horse race together in terms of what do I care more about, I think the evidence is increasingly supporting that that social emotional development, if you can get that part right, you're going to see a kid who's going to go farther in school and do better in the job market and earn more long term than if we just were worried about how do we mitigate the, you know, math and reading issues.
Okay, so break that down for a second, because that might have just buzzed through some of the parents listening. Parents, and I'm one of them, I focus a ton on, like, do your homework, you know, have you done your reading, have you done your math, all that sort of stuff. And it's at the expense often of hanging out with your friends and doing other social stuff. So
but you're doing two things there, right? So it's one thing is that they're doing their math and their reading.
Correct.
Right?
But I don't know if that's quite correct, but we're trying.
But there's also you're trying to help them develop the skills to regulate themselves so that they can do it on their own, right?
Yeah, prioritize their time. Yep.
So let's talk about what we know about, you know, so we're talking about schools largely, education system.
Yep.
So what do we know about how schools works, and how do we know that is also worth asking, right? So going to the very earliest ages, right? We've done a variety of randomized trials, right? Where we randomly put kids into things like Head Start, the Perry Preschool Scheme, yep. The ABC program. These are all the studies that were, people got randomly put in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We were able to say, where are they now, mm-hmm. right? As adults. And we know that the kids that got randomly put into these programs do much better than the kids that were in the pool, the control group that did not. It wasn't because they had necessarily always had better test scores. So we think a lot of that has to do with they learned social, emotional, soft, cognitive, non-cognitive, whatever skills you want to call it.
Something other than math and reading.
Yeah, at those ages, which allows them to thrive.
Okay.
Right?
So and when you're measuring the thriving down the road, it's more than just income.
Yeah, it's crime and educational attainment.
I just want to make sure listeners aren't just sort of dismissing the economist's study of thriving.
That's right. No, it's, you know, we're trying to use a broad-based measure of, and some of this is even self-reported, you know, well-being.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, that's preschool. So then we move into, you know, elementary school, kind of similar things, right? So one of the big studies, again, a randomized experiment in the 80s, Tennessee implemented this small class size called the STAR experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed immediately big increases in test scores. Everybody's like, small class sizes matter. Then we looked at the kids who participated in the experiment in high school, and it was like, there's not much here anymore, right? Then we followed it up again with their 27, 28, higher degrees of educational attainment, higher earnings, you know, so it kind of came back full circle. Again, it's like, well, what's going on? Something other than what we're measuring on test scores showed up, right? And then we, you know, a lot of what economists do in education is what we call value-added modeling.
Uh-huh.
So basically, you're trying to figure out if I went to this teacher or this school, how much learning should I expect, right? And we know that learning, cognitive learning, improved test scores, we've matched that to people long-term, and it does seem to matter. But several studies came out in the last couple of years, which also tried to do that value-added on non-cognitive skills, right?
Okay.
Students over time reporting things about their well-being, their own feelings of their social skills, and then match to like school disciplinary records. So we can say, look, you got this teacher versus that teacher. The students in this class, when we look at them going forward, they get in trouble less. They report greater feelings of well-being. And we're like, okay, well, there's clearly a teacher effect on the non-cognitive skills. And interestingly, they're not actually strongly correlated with the teachers who are good at generating cognitive skills.
Okay, so meaning that a teacher who is good at cultivating the non-cognitive skills is not necessarily
the one who's getting the best test scores.
Right, okay. We'll be back to my conversation with Bryce Ward after this short break. A New Angle is supported by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and UM's College of Business. Access to capital, broadband, and education are three ingredients any community needs for success.
This is Cameron Lawrence, and you're listening to A New Angle.
Hey, folks. The University of Montana will be hosting this year's first Presidential Lecture Series event on November 4th at 6 p.m. on Zoom. Visit www.umt.edu/president to register for the Zoom link and to hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Viet Thanh Nguyen. Welcome back to A New Angle. I'm speaking with economist Bryce Ward about the effects of COVID-19 on educational outcomes. We have a system in which the one who's getting the best test scores is often the one who's identified as the best teacher.
And, you know, interestingly, again, this was a study that was looked at ninth grade teachers. And in terms of completing high school graduation, if you're picking between having a one standard deviation better teacher on one of those two metrics, you absolutely want the teacher who was the better one at the non-cognitive skills.
So have you developed your own sort of questionnaire for how to identify these teachers?
That's such an interesting question. No, well, I'm curious. There's a totally separate paper on social skills that I would be curious if the measure of social skills they used actually correlates with this. Well, in fact, somebody should do this study because the measure they use is a paper by a guy named David Deming at Harvard. Basically, what they looked at team performance. And what they found was they could identify people who were the glue that made the team work better, right?
Okay.
And if you were to basically take and add this person to a team, it was in effect like increasing the IQ level of the team by a standard deviation.
Wow.
So who were these people, right? What was the test they used to identify them? It's a really cool test. You can go online and take it. You give people pictures of eyes and ask them to tell you what the emotion in the eye is.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
People who are good at reading facial expressions, particularly people's eyes. Now, whether or not that's the causal mechanism or just the way that we found to identify it, up in the air.
Sure.
But that was what they found. They had personality. They had all this other thing. The thing that was able to predict the people who were good is the eye reading test.
And talk about one thing that's been so much harder to do with COVID. Like it's very hard to do in Zoom.
Yeah. So this is part of the concern,
exactly.
Right? So there's the eye reading thing. And then another, again, a separate study, which again, isn't about education. Actually, it was about teachers. So there was a teacher training that I actually think a friend of mine implemented in South Africa. And they did it randomly with a control group, an online only arm, and a in-person arm.
Mm-hmm.
Both online and in person, they worked in that the teachers got better at their jobs, right? But the people that were in person got a lot better, right? And the mechanism that appeared, because the material was all the same.
Sure.
Right? So the information being delivered to you is identical.
Yep.
Right? So the thing that they found that was different was that the in-person arm increased motivation to pay attention, to learn, to engage. Right? That's what we've lost.
Speaking to a class of students live, the students feel some motivation to pay attention that they don't feel if it's the same students watching a video of me.
Well, we're extrapolating a little bit. So think of it as office hours.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
You know, a student in office hours where you're engaged and you can feel the energy in the room and you know, I can't alt tab into my browser when I, you know, get in a notification or whatever it is, I'm there, I'm engaged.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, you know, online, it's easy to be distracted.
100%.
You know, and particularly once you move from an individual to a small group or to a class, I mean, look, we've all been in the Zoom world now. The amount that I pay attention, if I don't need to, Zoom meeting is way less than what I was like daydreaming, right? Like, you know, I could daydream, sure.
Yeah.
But like I could passively pay a lot more attention because I didn't have literally any piece of information that I wanted to go look up at on my
100%.
On my lap, right? So the point is that we know that school works both because it's developing these important cognitive skills, and we know that those are important. I did mention that we've studied, again, that's Raj Chetty and Jonah Rockoff. You know, they did this long-term study of teacher value added models and, you know, income. But we have these new papers by a guy named Karabu Jackson looking at these non-cognitive value added and long-term outcomes. So we know both are important and we know that both have been interrupted. the test score piece, because we're tracking it all the time, we have a better sense of what we've lost.
Sure.
We know it's unequal. We know it's, you know, moderately sized. That how much we've lost in the social emotional, that's harder. And it's also harder because it's, look, if I can see that you're behind in test scores,
yeah,
remediating
you can
that
immediately observe
is,
it and do something
is, you know, we know, look, it requires resources to remediate. And the question is whether those resources will be made available to those who need it. But we know how to remediate it, right? Like, you know, if my kid gets behind in reading, oh, yeah, well, we've been slacking and not making you do your reading or whatever it is. So now we're going to amp it up and
yeah,
you'll get caught back up. We know less about the magic of what it is that actually is happening.
Yeah.
We, like, again, we've now got evidence that there are teacher effects and there are school effects. There's also a paper that looks at school effects on this. Interestingly, adding into this, same author, Karabu Jackson, and, well, main author than some of the other co-authors, they actually took advantage of school choice in Barbados, right? And they actually found that parents wanted to send their kids to the schools that were popular didn't actually have an effect on test scores. But long-term, they were having an effect on educational outcomes, meaning that parents were effectively selecting schools because they thought they were generating effects in these non-cognitive areas.
Sure.
So again, more evidence that this stuff is important and people are actually kind of aware of it, but we just don't, the actual recipe of it is hard, right? So just take a simple trait like resilience,
yeah,
right? Which is a trait that people think, yeah, I want my kid to be resilient. But, you know, I was just reading an article in the New York Times parenting thing just this week talking about resilience and how increasingly the idea is not, resilience itself isn't a trait. It's a network of other traits, right?
Yeah.
You know, and this is what happens when we kind of get into these social skills. There's just, it's easy to measure. Can you do a math problem?
Yeah, test scores.
Can you read
a
sentence? Right? But when it comes to even naming these non-cognitive, this is why they're frequently called soft skills, which is a term that I hate.
Essential skills is what we've rebranded them here at the College of Business as essential skills.
They're essential skills, and they are, the market is telling us that they're essential, right? Mm-hmm. We talked about this, I think, last time, where it was, you know, social skills married with analytical skills. Those are the jobs that have seen the most wage growth over the past 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm.
And will continue to with automation and all these other forces.
They are essential. You will work with other people. Mm-hmm. Most jobs entail working with other people in some form of group context, which means that people who are good at navigating, persuading, motivating, they're going to be very successful. And, you know, the big question to me about the long-term effects of COVID on kids, or just society in general, to be honest. Like, we were talking about this beforehand. We both feel like we've lost social skills.
Gosh, yeah.
Like, particularly with Delta, right? I felt like I was coming back out of it, right? In the spring, early summer. And then as Delta is kind of just start pulling back a little bit, because particularly with, you know, with somebody has kids who's not vaccinated, I'm not actually super concerned about them getting sick. I just don't want to have to quarantine with them for 10 days.
The disruption,
you know,
that it causes. I mean, I'm sure many listeners have been through this too, like just living through either being sick yourself or having a sick family member, or just the simple nuisance of getting that close contact notification from your kid's school is a heavy lift.
Yeah, a guy named Matt Voles, who lives in Helena but writes for Kaiser Health News. He wrote a very personal essay published this week about the four quarantines he's gone through with his kids,
yeah,
because of either, well, they got sick and they're waiting the test results, and so, well, it's 5 days to get the test results, and so you're stuck inside, and now you got the siblings who are also close contacts of this,
right.
and it's just like you got two parents trying to work, and you know, it's terrifying. I haven't had to go through it yet, fortunately, but it certainly is. You know, getting back to why I started talking about it, it's affected how I'm interacting with the world.
Yes.
As cases have now, again, they're in Missoula, they're high as they've ever been. And, you know, it's just kind of like, yeah, we got rid of the fear about my own health and, you know, maybe the health of the older people that are in my social network. You know, it's not they've gone to zero, but they've been mitigated by the vaccine. But the fact that there's still, you know, that miserable lockdown that we all went through, lockdown in March of 2020, that's still a real thing for parents.
It is.
And that's terrifying.
And you can sort of randomly get your life snapped back into it in a world where, you know, other people's lives aren't snapped back into that. Your employer isn't necessarily in that mode. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. You know, one thing, Bryce, in our remaining time, I mean, I think that one of the silver linings of this experience might be, you know, you mentioned that before pandemic, we started kind of understanding the value of these non-cognitive skills and maybe trying to get closer to understanding how they are cultivated within schools. And I think just the understanding in the community of their importance will make them more salient when we're trying to assess the effects of the pandemic on our kids. You know, if we know that, hey, this thing is much more important, then we're going to study the effect. Whether that means the effect is really bad or not, I don't know. Probably is. But at least we know to be looking there.
Yeah. And that's the key to remediation, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like I said, it's easy to say, oh, well, test scores are down. The average student is, you know, 6 percentiles below where we expected them to be, or 10 percentiles below where. Okay, fine. Like, oh, look, oh, and on the test, it's these areas, right? Like, we can tell you what math we need to remediate. Yeah. We can tell you what reading skills are missing because we have highly developed ways of measuring, you know, and we also have teachers who are professionals.
Yes.
And we go to conferences and they'll be, yeah, okay, like, this is where they're struggling. Go do this, right? But we, you know, there more and more curriculums and report cards have, they try and include some sort of social emotional skills, right? There's definitely being taught more in schools,
right?
But our ability to really assess the mechanisms, it's still very contentious, right? You know, even things like grit, which we hear a lot about,
oh, yeah,
are very contentious within the, you know, academic community because people are like, well, is it this? Is it that?
What, is it a real thing?
You know, and so we just don't, we know it's important. Right, we certainly know enough now to know that we've got to be tracking this, figuring out how to measure it, and figuring out how to remediate any losses that we've had.
Which means that more and more scholars will dedicate their careers to it. There are career rewards to being a scholar in that space. I mean, if you're studying something that nobody thinks is legit, nobody recognizes, you know, as a doctoral student or as anybody doing research, you're not going to go that route because you know there's no rewards to it.
Yeah, no, this is a massive change because this is what I wanted to study as a graduate student 20 years ago. And I mean, I went ahead and did it anyway, but every time I went and talked to my advisor about my latest thing,
bad idea.
He was like, well, what exactly are you doing? And, you know, I mean, he's in the same field as me and I was kind of, I could link it back, but it was a vague concept and it wasn't really clear what, you know, and that was, you know, honestly, I spent probably half a year in graduate school just trying to figure out what we were trying to talk about because everybody's talking past each other and all this kind of stuff.
You're ahead of your time as usual.
Not usual, but, but like, you know, it's definitely, you're right that it will get resources and hopefully we will get better at it. And, you know, that's all that we can really hope for because look, COVID has already happened, right? That cat's out of the bag. So all we can really hope to do is that use it as an opportunity to learn about key things about how the world works and hopefully figure out ways that we can identify and remediate any adverse effects so that we're not living with the effects of COVID forever.
Yeah, I think like that's a good place to end it, Bryce. This conversation about inequality will be a constant thread in Incentives and Instincts. I think it's largely the motivation behind the series, and it's just wonderful to share this time with you and hear your expertise on this topic. Thanks for being with us today, Bryce.
Thanks for having me as always.
Thanks for listening to A New Angle. We really appreciate it. And we're coming to you from Studio 49, a generous gift from University of Montana alums Michelle and Lauren Hansen. A New Angle is presented by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and the University of Montana College of Business. With additional support from Consolidated Electrical Distributors, Drum Coffee, and Montana Public Radio. AJ Williams is our producer. BTO, Jeff Ament, and John Wicks made our music. Editing by Nick Mott. And Jeff Meese is our master of all things sound. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.